News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with dietitian Amy Shea about nutrition for people with cancer, something I think that's critically important and I think will be of interest to all of our listeners. But first, Christy, we're going to talk about some really important research that some of it's simple and some of it's complex.
Well, this first one is about grapes. Are you a grape eater?
I'm an intermittent grape eater, kind of like people who take their medicines on an intermittent basis. I kind of eat grapes like for a couple days, and then I don't have them for a month. Should I be eating them more often?
Well, maybe. This is interesting to me because my son is basically raised on grapes. This is a study about grapes in the diet as it pertains to rats and any potential benefits.
Yeah, this was actually out of the University of Michigan Health Systems, and they fed these rats a grape-enriched diet for 3 months and then looked at their impact on several indicators of health.
And they found that the rats that got all these extra grapes in their diet had lower blood pressure, better heart function, and reduced indicators of inflammation in the heart. And they also found they had lower triglycerides, a part of the cholesterol component, and better glucose tolerance, suggesting that it had some benefits on their health.
And while we don't typically talk too much about articles and research that involve rats, not because we have a rat bias, but because we think that you should have it in human populations. This is interesting to Christy and I for a lot of different reasons. First off, you know, the grapes are the things that go into wine. Wine has some cardiovascular benefit there. And also, it doesn't appear that grapes would have a lot of risk of taking grapes, and it's something simple to do, and you can get that in all kinds of ways besides just eating grapes.
Sure. So it doesn't answer all the questions, but it suggests that there may be some benefits. And we know there are other benefits from eating fruit and fiber. So we might as well.
All I can say is, first, I want them to be organic grapes because I don't like the grapes that are not organic that have really kind of some bitter taste to the skin and pesticides. And the second thing is I like them without seeds. What about you?
I like them without seeds, but I just buy the regular grapes and wash them.
We'll have to work on that.
Okay.
What's our very next research that matters, Christy?
Our next one is about the personal genome and whether or not you should spend what has been $10,000 and now could cost only $1,000 for information about your own personal genome.
Yeah, you know, we had Dr. Evans, medical geneticist at UNC, here on the show not too long ago, really kind of looking at this. And I think we're wanting to talk about this some more because it continues to come. And at $10,000, I don't think many listeners out there are going to have this test. But at $1,000 or $100, a lot of people probably would. And this was really looking at a parent of someone who a 19-year-old relative died suddenly in their sleep, and this adult wanted to know, well, are they have some risk of the same sorts of things in sudden death?
Well, and this was an article that came out in The Lancet, which is a really important journal for doctors, and really kind of looks at the different ethical and medical issues that arise when people start getting this information that doctors don't necessarily know what to do with. And so they did raise some questions and things we should think about before proceeding with getting this information.
Yeah, and in addition to which, you know, there was information that this person got that actually they found useful. You know, they found out that they did carry three gene variants that were linked to sudden cardiac death, including a risk for a heart attack, a risk for clogged arteries, and type 2 diabetes. But as this person, I think, said is, you know, that there were lots of things they found out that they really didn't necessarily want to. They were at risk for just all kinds of diseases. But they maybe found a couple things that were helpful to them.
Well, but even that information about at risk for heart disease and other things, I mean, you might get that just by getting their family history and by some blood tests and looking at their blood pressure. So the question is that new information for you? And then what are you going to do with that information?
Well, yes, but he did find, Christine, I'll be curious what you think about this, that he's genetically more likely to respond to low doses of cholesterol-lowering drugs with a lower risk of side effects. And I think a lot of people are concerned about the side effects of those drugs, and that, and if they found out that they were more likely to benefit and less likely to have side effects, maybe they would take them. I think that's actually one of the small pieces of really good things that some of these new genetic tests might be able to tell us. I don't know what you think.
Well, I think it'd be a lot cheaper to, if you have high cholesterol, to start on a medication and see if it makes a difference than to spend that much money to find out if you have the genetic predisposition. But there may be some patients out there in tricky circumstances where that could be helpful. But I think most people, not so much.
So more to come and no strong answers yet. But our next one actually is one that we have strong answers for. And this
yes,
was
we
an
do.
Article in the Archives of Internal Medicine that really looks at the combination of smoking, drinking too much, poor diet, and lack of exercise. What do those things combine, Christy, to tell us about what's likely to happen?
Yeah, kind of scary. I mean, we know those are things that we do not recommend for people. But what happens combined? So this is a study in the Archives of Internal Medicine looking at almost 5,000 people age 18 years or older, and they followed them over two decades. They interviewed them or got information based on their health behaviors of the things you mentioned, smoking, exercising, their diet, and drinking alcohol in the United Kingdom, and then followed them over two decades to see who died and why and what happened to their health.
Yeah, and as we know that when you have a risk factor like smoking, that you are going to less likely to live as long. But when you actually start adding these things together, it's cumulative. And the impact overall on people's lives, I thought, was pretty substantial.
Well, the fact that the people who did those things, smoked, don't exercise, eat poorly, and drink alcohol, that person is three times more likely to die from cardiovascular disease and nearly four times more likely to die of cancer than the people who had healthier behaviors.
Right. And I think I've seen elsewhere that this is at least 4 years worth of life. You know, this is a substantive amount. And, of course, the great range is how well you age and the illnesses that you age as well.
They found in the study that the people who did those behaviors had an overall premature death risk equivalent to being 12 years older than they were. So it definitely –
another way of looking at that,
yeah,
about,
it's the same.
Kind of older and getting their –
right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
so,
no, big and important. Well, this last one is a very interesting research that matters, because we've been talking about colon cancer and the benefits of the currently really best test that we have available for it, which is a colonoscopy. We had Dr. Sid Levinson on the show not too long ago talking about that. And this is an article, Christy, in The Lancet about maybe a newer type of colon cancer test or a modification of existing test.
So this was done in Britain. And in the United Kingdom, the government funds colon cancer screening at age 60. And so this was research used to test people in their 50s by using a 5-minute colon cancer test to see if that could reduce people's chance of getting colon cancer.
And we couldn't exactly tell fully, but it appears that they're really using a newer instrument that's perhaps smaller, thinner, more flexible, but doesn't go as far as a colonoscopy. It only goes up into the initial part of the colon to look for those precancerous polyps and then differentiating whether or not you need to have anything else done, whether or not you see those in that part of the colon.
And they found that the people using this flexiscope test reduced people's chance of getting colon cancer by a third. And it also cut their chances of dying by 43%. So pretty remarkable results.
And I think it's too soon for really anyone to make full use of this. There are still multiple ways that one can go about, according to guidelines, screening for colon cancer. The gold standard still really is today a colonoscopy
in the United States.
And in an editorial that went with this article, one of the experts who actually comes to the University of North Carolina, Dr. David Ransohoff, talked about that you might be able to combine this with some other test. But we're still a little ways away from that, and I think we're still going to recommend colonoscopies.
Mm-hmm. And talk to your doctor about colon cancer screening of some sort. So we've had a chance to talk about several articles of research that matters. We've talked about grapes in your diet.
We've talked about maybe that there are some reasons you might get a genetic test, but a lot of people really won't do that.
A bit about having a poor lifestyle through smoke and lack of exercise and how that may affect your lifespan.
And then really maybe some new research that's emerging for maybe make it easier for people to get screening for colon cancer.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Amy Shea about cancer nutrition. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking about nutrition for people with cancer. And this is a topic that I think increasingly is important to really all of our listeners, Christy, because we all know people who have cancer and family members and friends and even ourselves. And nutrition is just such a critical part now of cancer care.
I am happy to have this conversation today. This is something so many of our patients are interested in, what foods to eat or not eat if you're if you have cancer. So I'd like to welcome Amy Shea. Ms. Shea is the outpatient oncology dietitian at UNC Chapel Hill. She provides nutritional counseling and therapy to cancer patients and families at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital. She earned her undergraduate degree in nutritional science from the University of Maryland, College Park, and her Master's of Public Health in Nutrition from the UNC Gillings School of Public Health. She is a licensed and registered dietitian and is board certified as a specialist in oncology nutrition. So thank you so much, Ms. Shea, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, one of the things that I think our listeners and Christy and I would really like to know is, I don't think people wake up one day – I mean, people know what a dietitian does, I think. That's really well known. But I don't think people would just know, well, what's an oncology nutritionist? And so I wonder, how did you wake up and what was the path to becoming a nutritionist? What got you really motivated? And then how did you move into a really specialized field that is really so important?
Sure. Good question. Well, actually, if you had asked me 10 years ago if I'd be doing oncology nutrition, I probably would have said no, and I would have had no idea that this is what I would be doing. But one thing I love about the field of nutrition is that you can do so many different things. And so initially, when I first was interested in nutrition, it was really just because I believed in the value of food and making us feel better and really promoting overall health. And so then I pursued the undergraduate degree in nutrition. And at the time, I was actually pre-med. And then after several years in nutrition, in undergrad, I decided that I wanted to specialize in nutrition instead and be a dietitian. I didn't know what a dietitian was when I started undergraduate school. And then with some internships and things, I met dietitians, and I was like, that's what I want to do. So then going on to public health school at UNC, you're just exposed to so many different things. And initially, when I came out of school, I worked in diabetes practice. And then moving back here to North Carolina, there was an opening for the outpatient position in the cancer center. And I just thought this would be such a great opportunity to get into such an interesting field that's so, you know, cutting edge, I guess. And there's so many things going on nowadays with nutrition and cancer and just cancer in general that I thought it'd be really interesting to get involved with. And
you must see almost, if not every patient, basically almost, that comes through there because this is an issue for virtually all of them at some point in time in their cancer care, I would
right.
think.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, thinking about the nutritional needs of patients with cancer. There's so many different types of cancer and so many people at different stages of cancer that how do you really assess and think about the variety of needs that people with cancer may have?
Sure. And that brings up a really good point. And one thing I love so much about oncology nutrition is that it is so varied. But my goal with each individual patient is to sit down with them and to really go through their medical history, their nutritional history, and to find out, well, what concerns do they have and what can I do to individualize the therapy? And you're exactly right. I mean, the nutrition for a breast cancer patient can be very different for nutrition for a lung cancer patient or a stomach cancer patient. And so it's all about sort of tailoring, and that's one thing that's been a huge challenge, you know, coming into the oncology nutrition field is having to learn so much, you know, that we weren't necessarily taught in school, but there's a lot more out there about how to tailor things for
patients. Let's say I have a loved one that's been recently diagnosed with breast cancer, and they're going to have some surgery, a lumpectomy to remove a portion of the cancer. They're going to have some radiation therapy, and because of the type of cancer there that's in a lymph node, they're going to probably have some chemotherapy. Where do you get involved? Help us understand, what is a tailored nutritional approach to this particular scenario?
Sure. Good question. And so with that particular scenario, most of the breast cancer patients, the typical chemotherapies that they're getting, one of them in particular tends to be associated with a lot of nausea. And so my job is to, hopefully if I meet them early enough, we can talk about nutritional strategies to manage nausea. You know, what foods can they choose to help manage nausea? Other behavioral strategies that they can do to help manage that.
Like what? What types of foods would you normally?
So I guess the biggest thing would really be more of a behavioral strategy would be to eat more regularly so that they're eating about every 2 to 3 hours, keeping something on the stomach can help keep nausea at bay. And then as far as foods, you know, one thing that I see that I think is kind of interesting is, you know, people will say, oh, I didn't have any problem with nausea, and then I ate pizza, you know, or something that's kind of heavy or greasy. And so avoiding those kinds of foods when you think your nausea is going to be at its worst. And then even sometimes more of a sort of natural remedy, like trying ginger foods, because ginger has natural anti-nausea properties. So for that patient, you know, we would probably talk about those particular side effects from chemo and what they could do to manage it. And, you know, luckily with breast cancer, from surgery, the surgery and radiation standpoint, there aren't a lot of nutritional issues that the patients face. And so, you know, in that case, we talk more about, well, what can they do to focus on healthy nutrition to keep them going for as long as possible and more overall survival.
And what sort of tips do you give to people in that scenario who maybe they've overcome cancer and have survived it and beaten it, but are trying to either prevent a recurrence or to be as healthy as they can?
Right. So I always go back to the American Institute for Cancer Research guidelines. And in the, I believe it was the fall of 2007, they put out a summary report with the World Cancer Research Fund summarizing all of the international literature and research on nutrition, cancer, and physical activity. And sort of the general kind of recommendations that came out of this report are to focus on a plant-based diet. And so it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be vegetarian, and I don't push that on anybody, but just focusing more on getting in your healthy fruits and vegetables, your whole grains, your beans and nuts, just overall healthy plant foods that we all know are good for us. And then we kind of work on strategies. Well, how do I do that? And you know, convenience items, whether it's buying the, you know, pre-chopped broccoli and using that or you know, having freshly washed fruit available in the refrigerator so that it's easy. Just lots of different strategies, but really focusing on plant-based nutrition as they move into that sort of survivorship phase.
I know we're going to want to come back to really some specifics in different types of cancers after our break. But I do want to ask you a question that you kind of raise this evidence-based approach. And Christy and I really talk about what does the research really show. And it reminds me that when I was a third-year medical student, the first research paper I ever wrote was on psychosocial aspects of cancer and really looking at the data. And at the time when I was looking at nutrition and cancer, clearly it was considered alternative medicine at some respects. And it's clear now with your position, seeing all these cancer patients in the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, state-of-the-art cancer center, that it's part of medicine. How did this happen? Was it that we now have lots of data on the impact? And what does that data show?
Yeah, and I think it is true that the data is growing. And you know, I think oncology nutrition as a whole is still a very young science, but we do have more and more evidence pointing out how important nutrition is. There are randomized clinical trials, which is the gold standard for research on nutrition and cancer outcomes. And So there are intervention trials where there would be, you know, a control group that receives no intervention and then a group that receives counseling from a dietitian. And the patients in the counseling group were able to maintain their weight and improve maintain their nutritional status throughout chemotherapy and radiation. And there are several of these trials in different cancer populations, whether it's head and neck cancer or GI or different things.
I mean, and, you know, Adam brings up another interesting point about just that you're talking about the psychosocial aspects of cancer care way back when you wrote that article years ago. And yet here it is tied in with nutrition, food, eating with your family. And that's such a an important part of our experience in our families and in our lives. And yet people with cancer are struggling with so much already that then to have these different issues, whether it be nausea or, you know, inability to or no appetite, interfering with that can have some profound effects on just the quality of life in their family. And I would imagine you're doing some counseling around those strategies as well.
Sure. And we're lucky to have a really good sort of psycho-oncology team at UNC as well to help address those other issues, because sometimes, you know, eating is so much more than just eating, and there are a lot of sort of mental health issues that go with it too.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but I know when we come back we want to really pick up on this theme, because it sounds like, yes, you are a dietitian, nutritionist, specialist in oncology, but it sounds like you also play lots of roles as part of a team approach, and I know we want to talk about that. We're going to be continuing our conversation after a break with our guest Amy Schaaf from the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, talking about cancer nutrition. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Amy Schaaf, who's a dietitian at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, about nutrition and cancer. And Ms. Schaaf, we were talking a little bit about the psychosocial aspects of eating and nutrition and the fear that comes along with a cancer diagnosis. And you're in a very intimate place with patients to really hear about their concerns and their fears. What do you hear from patients about their expectations or fear to even perhaps come and talk to you?
Well, I'd say I don't know if anybody has a fear to talk to me, but they do. You know, it's amazing how scary eating can be. And, you know, I've had several patients with this particular scenario, but one in particular that I can think of who has had surgery to remove her stomach. And, you know, if you think about it, once you've changed your GI tract such that you don't have a major organ, eating can be very frightening, and especially when you are told prior to the surgery that these are the side effects that you may have. You know, you may experience certain GI symptoms, nausea, heartburn, different kinds of things. And so it's amazing how eating can become such a big deal. And it really, you know, people are scared to eat even the simplest things that they used to be able to enjoy. And so sometimes for me, it's really a challenge to help them move beyond that fear and just try, you know, just taste it, just see, you know, just take a few bites and let's see what happens. And so that gets to be tricky.
And I'm thinking of a particular patient of mine when her family was pushing so much eat, eat, eat as the one thing the family could do to try to control that situation, something that you really can't control how a person feels. And I would imagine you have some of those issues that come up as well.
Yeah, it's always a struggle between the caregivers and the patient. Not always, but oftentimes. And I guess sort of a rule that I like to sort of preach or explain to my patients is that it's the patient's responsibility to eat, and it can be the caregiver's role to prepare the food. So whatever the patient wants, the caregiver can do, and that can be their job, but not to get in a fight over food, because it just makes it that much harder for the patient to eat and to celebrate even the smallest things. You know, I think sometimes family members and caregivers are expecting the patient to eat a normal sized meal, and normal is changed. You know, normal may now be three bites, and that's great. You know, and we have to celebrate that as something, you know, as a positive accomplishment for the patient.
How do you track? I mean, you know, there's all these competing things about, you know, quantity of life, quality of life, the right amount of nutrition, or as you just mentioned, some kind of small successes. How do you balance out And how do you frame this? Because there could be guilt associated with this, both for the patient and the family about not eating enough. And you mentioned, you know, moving towards a plant-based diet. But some people really, if particularly if their quantity of life may not be too long, maybe they're just interested in the quality and enjoying the foods. I'm just wondering, there's all these competing demands out there. How do you do it in your own mind? How do you get this around your hands around this?
Yeah, it's a really common struggle that I have internally, I guess. And, you know, I always try to phrase or to discuss things in an objective manner and you know, just trying to go with the facts and just what did you eat? Can you explain this to me? And you know, not putting sort of pressure on the patient in any way. But it can be a challenge. And I think that you have to – it goes back to the individualization that I was mentioning at the beginning. You know, if there is a patient who we know that the quantity of life is not necessarily very long, you know, maybe we don't push the plant-based approach and we go more with whatever they're interested in eating and whatever they can enjoy. And so it kind of just depends on where the patient's at and, you know, and I think what I try to do in my counseling, in my work with patients, is to focus on letting them be the driver of the bus so that, you know, they're in control and, mm-hmm. and everything that we do is up to them. I will certainly give suggestions and ideas, but it's not my job to force them or tell them what they should do.
Well, I think that's a huge
very
point.
Very patient-centered.
And it's, again, a pretty radical transformation from where maybe medicine was at 10 and 20 years ago. And I'm wondering, you know, also you're in a new cancer hospital, and what's it like in terms of working with all of these other providers in the cancer hospital? What's that like, and how receptive? How do you do this team stuff with your work?
It can certainly be overwhelming because there's one of me, and I don't even know how many doctors we have. Many. So it's a challenge because I'm working with all the different disease groups and, you know, we have interdisciplinary teams in every single disease group. So there's a lung cancer team with, you know, the medical oncologists who do the chemo. There's the radiation oncologists, the surgeons, the nurses, you know, just the whole group of people for each disease state. And then there's one of me that goes with all of them. And so
Every cancer, every drug, a little bit, and every disease state.
Yeah, exactly. And so it can be very overwhelming. But I think I feel that our physicians and other practitioners are very receptive to nutrition. You know, again, as long as it's something that's evidence-based, and that's what I try to focus all of my, you know, counseling strategies on. I mean, am I going to recommend some crazy out there thing? You know, probably not. And we need to have, you know, fairly solid evidence before I am willing to recommend something. And I find that our doctors are very appreciative of our services.
Well, it's great that with this multidisciplinary team approach where, you know, it's like a whole circle of people surrounding the patient that we include both the medical science, surgical, chemotherapy, those things, but also think about wellness, about nutrition, about, you mentioned counseling earlier, that our cancer center is really using all the different important key people to take care of that patient.
And it sounds like, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, like nausea, but there are other things that cancer patients have, things like they can't swallow or head and neck cancers and the radiation. What do you do both on the short term? What do you recommend for things like that? And then also for the survivors, someone with breast cancer who we know that some of what is maybe a risk factor for them with some of their dietary habits. What do you do the short term and how do you do the long term counseling?
Well, I guess in the immediate short term, while they're on active treatment, the main goal is really weight stability. And, you know, most of what I see tends to be weight loss. And so, you know, we're just trying to kind of prevent that and work against that. And in some ways, it's sort of whatever they can get down. You know, like you mentioned, if they're having swallowing trouble, well, then they may be drinking a lot of milkshakes, you know, and, mm-hmm. and that's okay.
Higher calorie,
right.
Higher protein.
Exactly. And if, you know, I think putting it in perspective, if it's 3 months where your diet maybe doesn't look the healthiest, but you're getting it down and you're maintaining your weight, then that's going to be better in the long run. I mean, we know we have studies that show that weight loss affects prognosis. And so I'd rather see someone maintain their weight on, you know, ice cream then lose, you know, 50 pounds in 2 months. So it's a challenge for sure. And then beyond that, the survivorship kinds of things. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, the plant-based focus, but also getting into the physical activity and just other kinds of wellness things that, that patients can do. You know, we're lucky, like we talked about earlier, to have a nice team, and we have a big survivorship program at UNC, and we've done several different programs that patients can attend. There's a particular program that we do every so often that's a six-week program that features different topics each week. And then as part of that, we do a nutrition piece, like a little nutrition lesson each time, and then we do a physical activity component. And I'm actually an exercise instructor as well, so I get to lead that too. So it's just, you know, there's just so many things that we can do. And, you know, I try to focus on, for the survivors, little baby steps. You know, if they eat one more piece of fruit today than they did yesterday, then that's an accomplishment.
Now, it sounds like being an oncology nutritionist or dietitian is a highly specialized field, and that if there's only one of you to go through the whole cancer hospital, there must not be many of you in the area. How does someone get advice if they don't have a nutritionist with your area of specialty?
Well, a lot of cancer centers, more and more cancer centers are hiring dietitians, which is wonderful. And even if the dietitian doesn't have the oncology specialization, he or she can certainly offer, you know, helpful advice. The specialization is actually a very recent credential. It just came out maybe in 2008, I think it was. So, and you have to sit for an exam and have a certain number of hours in the field. But you know, that's a good question, too.
And people who want – are people in the community able to make appointments to get for their loved ones, or if they're in UNC healthcare system, is there a number they get to call if they're interested in making appointments?
Yes. If they're going to – if they would like to make an appointment with me and they're a patient at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, their appointment line for me is 919-966-3093. And then they can also go on to the UNC Limeburger Cancer Center website and find additional info on how to meet with me.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being with us and for what you're doing for our patients.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Amy Shea, oncology dietitian at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, and thank you so much for being our guest today. Coming up on House Calls, when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have some personal experiences or family experiences and some questions, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. We'll read them on an upcoming show and give you our thoughts.
And now we'll have our executive producer, Julie Steiner, read some of our recent house calls.
Our first listener writes, I am 65 years old, and I have a friend with some mild memory problems. Is memory loss always a part of aging?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm sure it actually is something relevant to not only you and your friend, it's relevant to really all of us.
It is, and it's a tough thing because we do have some memory changes as we age and get older, but the question is, where is the spectrum of normal, and when is it a concern? And clearly, this is something that concerns you and your friend.
One of the things to know is that certain things that are kind of normal as we get older, which is sometimes we have a harder time bringing back the exact thought that we might have had. We might have a harder time remembering the name of a specific person or place. And so it takes maybe a little bit longer. Sometimes that stuff will come back to us, but maybe not as quick as it did when we were younger. On the other hand, most people who have memory problems aren't aware they have memory problems.
And if you find that you or your loved one has trouble following directions or gets lost in the neighborhood or has trouble balancing a checkbook, some of these things are leaves. We all, you know, occasionally make mistakes, but if repeatedly leaving the stove on and leaving the house or that sort of thing, if you're having those sorts of problems, that's something you really should bring in to talk to the doctor about.
particularly things sometimes are what we call the recent memory. Most people are going to remember their birthday. They're going to remember how many children. They're going to remember a lot of things that are stored in the longer-term memory. But the recent memory – so for instance, if you had a conversation with someone and a couple hours later you talk with them and they didn't remember having a conversation with you, again, that would be something mm-hmm. very concerning. And be worth talking to your primary care provider.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question. Julie, what's our next house call?
It seems like so many people have arthritis. Is osteoarthritis a normal part of aging, or can it be prevented?
Well, that's a really good question. And with two good, really things that people don't ask about enough, I don't think. You know, typically we think about I coming in with joint pain and do I have osteoarthritis? And that's the more common question, but you're not really asking that.
So osteoarthritis in that disease process, it is sort of the wearing down and the breakdown of the cartilage between the joints. And it is something that happens more and more as we age, and the more sort of pounding and use we've had on those joints, the more damage that can occur over time. So the question is, it does it always happen with aging? We'll always know. But is it a part of aging? Sure. They're very closely linked.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we were to ask, you know, I'm thinking back, Christy, to one of my patients who was 102, and the only medication she was on was a baby aspirin because her joints hurt occasionally. And I oftentimes said that you're healthier than me. So I don't know if you need to keep coming back to see me regularly. But there is something about almost everyone probably has some amount. But on mm-hmm. the other hand, some people have a lot more than others, both on a genetic basis but also a lifestyle basis.
Yep. And so you talk about what can you do to prevent it. And the biggest thing is to exercise and keep your weight at a healthy level. Your weight makes a big difference on your knees and your hips and the amount of damage that goes into them over time.
And on the other extreme, you know, the people who are doing excessive sorts of exercising, sometimes the your triathlons, who are the people doing excessive running, particularly on concrete, or people who are in some sports like tennis, there seems to be some association with them developing some arthritis in their back and their neck. So
from, you know, overuse.
From overuse. So I think there is a happy medium here for most people. But certainly weight loss for the great majority of people who are overweight will have a big impact.
Okay, Julie, what's next?
I am getting older, and I've noticed that I don't like visiting friends and family as much as I used to. Is this normal for an older person, or should I be concerned?
Well, it probably depends a little bit on your family.
Well, that's true. They may not.
I don't know.
Good point,
in
Adam.
Our family, sometimes.
Well, and I
but
think.
But in all seriousness.
Well, and you say, should I be concerned? I think if you're writing in, should you be concerned, then clearly you are concerned, and that's
absolutely
worth looking into. Then some things that come to mind are, you know, some people, as they get older, have trouble hearing. And so it's not fun to go into family, big family events, because it's harder to hear and understand people, and that could be uncomfortable.
Much less being in your car and not being able to even hear your grandchildren or children in the back seat and you're in the front seat.
You also want to think, though, about if you're feeling more withdrawn, are you feeling down or depressed, or are there reasons why you're just not having the same amount of energy or desire to talk with other people?
Because it's clear that getting depressed at any age, particularly as you get older and becoming socially isolated, maybe as some friends have passed away or some loss that you've experienced, can actually make depression come on and can make it worse and make it more difficult to come out of a depression. So we would be very much wanting to have a conversation with you about what your current lifestyle is like, what your current views are about life and happiness and hope and fear and depression.
Absolutely. So this is one of those things that there's not a quick answer to of yes, it's normal or no, it's not. But that it really is worth sitting down and talking with your primary care physician to try to work through and really explore what are the underlying issues. So I hope you'll have that conversation with your doctor.
Julie, what's our very last house call?
I am 53, and my doctor said I need a preventive visit. What exactly is preventive care? Does she mean I need a pap smear?
Sort of. Really good question. And, you know, that's a term I think, Adam, you and I toss out a lot, that, you know, it's about preventive medicine or preventive care. And that's what we do as family doctors. We certainly treat people for their medical problems, but also really focus on wellness and staying healthy.
Well, and there's some terms I don't think we've ever defined on the show before. Let me just quickly say it. There's what's called primary prevention. That's really preventing something from ever coming on, such that you never have the problem, like not eating salt, so you'll never get high blood pressure. And then there's what's called secondary prevention, and that's when you have you're taking a cholesterol medicine because maybe you've had a heart attack. And then there's even a tertiary prevention once you've experienced something even down the road. So in all cases, actually, we could talk about prevention not just from the primary, but other things you could do that actually could prevent other things from happening.
So in a preventive visit, your doctor will sit down and go through your medical history, your medications, your family history, all of the things that relate your social history, meaning what do you drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes?
Or drink too much.
Mm-hmm. And through all that information, your doctor will tailor recommendations based on your age and your history that would help to keep you healthy or screen to see if you have any development of an illness that we really can make a difference on if we diagnose it early.
Like osteoporosis. Maybe you already have osteoporosis, but we can prevent a hip fracture. That's secondary and tertiary prevention there because you've already developed the disease.
So things like colon cancer screening, talk about mammograms, pap smears certainly is part of that, bone health, there are many things. So you should have that visit and talk with your doctor more about what that means to you.
Well, we're going to probably take a little break right now, Christy. I think that'll conclude our show today. We've been able to talk about a variety of things here on House Calls that are important, hopefully, to all of our listeners.
And we thank you for joining us today for Your Health. And you can email your health-related questions and experiences at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, and UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Amy Shea from the North Carolina Cancer Hospital. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. Take care.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.